floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Ladies and gentlemen, how you doing? It's walking the floor time once again. We're back this week with part two of my epic Brad Paisley interview. And as always, I'm joined here in the Walking the Floor studio by my good friend and bandmate, Luke Tierney. What's happening, Luke?
Hi, everybody.
You know, oh, I'm sorry, I almost just catch up. No. What's happening, Luke?
Hi, everybody.
You know, before we get into the interview, I think we should talk about something that's pretty important in our world, and that is my debut as a flail.
Yes.
Yes. We didn't do a Dead Peasants gig, but we did play together at Three Clubs.
Yeah.
And tell the world, tell the Walking the Floor community about the flails. What are the flails?
Well, the flails is, it's at its core is our friend Mark and me drinking beer and pushing record on the Pro Tools.
Yes.
And then whoever else we can con into doing that with us. It was never really intended to be a live thing, but we've done that now, and you are now part of that. You obviously were on a record before, but you were part of our largest live crew, which was 15 people strong.
It was large, on a stage that can comfortably fit about three.
Yeah, it was made for
amazing.
A power trio.
Yes. I was stoked. I think that was the only guy that the sound man had to come up to in the middle of it and go like, hey, man, you need to turn down.
Did he really?
Yeah, because I guess I was too loud.
I couldn't hear you.
Well, neither could I. That's why I was cranking. But, you know, I guess I was ripping it in the room.
Well,
who knew?
I look forward to watching video of it from the front, so I think I will be able to hear you, but who knows?
You'll probably hear me too much, because there were some epic, in keeping with the name of the band, I had some epic flails, like capoing the, you know, guitar on the wrong fret by a half step and things like that.
Some of that's on me, I realize.
That's technical speak. I realize we're boring everybody out there. You know, that doesn't sound good. That's what that means. Well, you know, the beauty of playing with like 15 people is that mistakes don't really count. It's that you can't possibly make a mistake that's going to really derail a 15-man band unless all 15 of the people are pretty much making the same mistake at the same time.
Which is hard. That would be really hard to do.
Really tough to do.
It's kind of like eating a big pizza that has everything you like on it, but if you like don't like onions and there's just one little piece of onion in there, it's
who's gonna
not, yeah, it's
who's
not
gonna,
really not gonna
it's not
blow
yeah, because even slip that by my kids.
Yeah.
Hey, tell me how your life has changed in the last couple weeks in the aftermath of Walking the Floor's interview with Brad Paisley, part one, that, as we all know, pretty much broke the internet. With downloads and streams.
Yes.
Are you getting recognized everywhere you go?
You know, I used to be pretty anonymous out there in the world.
Yeah,
but,
baby.
That has definitely changed in the last couple
that's
of
weeks. That's right. But just your voice.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Someone hears me ordering a latte and they go, dude. Walk on the floor.
Tell me about Paisley. I got to say, it's a big treat when you interview somebody like Brad Paisley who then tweets about the link for the interview.
Super cool.
Because the guy's got like over 3 million Twitter followers. That's insane. I have serious Twitter envy right now. I'm not doing my job over there in Twitter land.
Yeah, well,
he's holding it down. This part two, the back half of my talk with Brad, we talked about his gear. Are you a gearhead?
In theory, I mean, I get the, like, when I walk into a guitar store, I get the sort of dopamine response of, like, oh, God, I wish I owned all of this. When it comes to touring, I kind of, I'm like, is there any way I could do this with just a guitar cable and an amp? Is that possible?
I still struggle to figure out, like, you know, what the different tubes do and why you want to, you know, a tube screamer for this thing over that. I don't know. I don't get it. I love gear. And it was cool to hear somebody like Brad that actually knows the ins and outs. I mean, he's the guy's like, you know, a genius with that stuff. But he also gives a rundown on the music business and touring. And probably my favorite part of the whole interview is that all the way at the very end, he starts talking about his time with Buck Owens. He was actually really good friends with Buck Owens.
Which is crazy. He just seems too young to have had that much time with him.
But he did. Yeah. And he tells about it right here. Walking the floor, Brad Paisley. I wanted to ask you about some music industry stuff, and that kind of segues into it. And I know that you have a degree in music business, and I think you worked at some labels
Which
or
will
something.
Get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks if you
also have
money in your wallet.
Can you talk a little bit about when you moved to Nashville and were working, having to work a day job, and then were you gigging around town? Like, how has your experience, you know, not only studying music business in college, but also working in the music business before you were like a solo artist, has that helped you navigate your career?
Yeah, it's in every way, because I'm sort of a I'm very complicated, I think, in many ways, an odd duck in that I can be very quiet. I'm sort of a quiet observer. And then when I need to be, I can be the loudest person in the room if I have to be, you know, in terms of talk the most or figure out. But when I first got to Nashville, my strategy was I'm just going to go to the school and I'm not going to tell anybody what I really want to do, because I figured out that most of the kids that were going to Belmont had some sort of plan to be singer, songwriter, or whatever. And so to be yet another voice saying that's what I want to do wouldn't mean anything. And I didn't want to get anybody rolling their eyes the minute I say, yeah, I want a record deal, you know, or something. So people would say, what do you do? And I'd say, I'm a guitar player. And they'd say, oh, cool. And then they'll say, what do you play like? And I'd say, well, you know, I play about anything, really, whatever you want. And so I started getting steady work as, like, the session player at Belmont. Because there's a studio that you can use for free as long as you book the time. And all those kids that are playing, it's a lot like Berkeley that way, but you can go and... And, you know, somebody wrote a song and they want to get players, and they pay you with, like, I don't know, you get credits for doing it. So that, you know, it's sort of a small little microcosm of what it's like.
Right.
And so the whole first year I didn't tell a soul that I sang or wrote songs. Not anybody. And I played backup in all of the songwriter showcase for a girl that was a great singer, and country showcase for her. I was in her band, and she was great because she would be like, she figured out originally... Or she figured out right away. It's like, well, let's do a fast bluegrass tune. Let's write a bluegrass song because he can play that fast stuff.
Right.
So she did like a, and it's like, gave me the big solo.
Yeah, nice.
In the middle of that, and so everybody's like, and I had a friend of mine that's still my best friend to this day. His name's Kelly Lovelace, and we share a farm. I sold him 5 acres on the farm. That was our goal in college. First, the way we met was I played the songwriter showcase within my first 2 months. I played the guitar, and she gave me this tear it up. Solo it like whatever, how many beats a minute, bluegrass tune, and I tore it up, and you know, like the school went nuts because they were like, "Whoa, you know, this guy can play this stuff." Because I came from this background of, like you say, playing bars, and I wasn't some kid that was in college to learn. I'd already figured
out
how to play
at that point.
Yeah, it was more about there to learn about this town. I wanted to figure out how to fit in, and so his first thing he ever walked up to me was he walks up and goes, "You're a superstar." And he just meant that as a guitar player, which was really nice of him. And I said, well, thanks. I don't know about that. But so we became best friends, and he's co-written a lot of songs on my records with me. His dream was to be a writer. So the second year I was there, I stayed up with the guy who became my producer, Frank Rogers, late one night. I had written some songs, and I said, I had a song called Another You. And I said, let's turn this in as the demo to get into the country showcase. So we worked all night on this demo in the studio, got it great, and turned it in, and was chosen of the 5 people to perform in the country showcase. And everybody went, he sings? Because they had just thought I was like a session player.
Right.
So all of a sudden I get up and I do the song at the showcase, and everybody was like, they'd gotten to know me another way, and they knew that I was committed to interning at ASCAP and these places, and they knew that I was a guitar player and that I was for hire as a session player. And it was really nice to have built that foundation. And then by the time I graduated college, I moved right from there to EMI as a songwriter.
Really?
Yeah.
So you were a staff songwriter for a while?
Mm-hmm.
And how
I
did that?
I was signed to EMI 2 weeks. I had offers during school, but I said I'm not. I was way more savvy than I feel like I am today. But I was like, I'm not signing anything until I graduate.
Right.
And barely graduated. 2.5 and had to test out of business because I forgot to take it when I transferred. Business 101, that is.
Oh, funny.
Tested out like 3 weeks prior to graduation.
Really?
I had the cap and gown. I wouldn't have been able to walk if I didn't pass.
Right.
You needed an 80 to test out.
Uh-huh.
And I got an 81.
Nice.
Which is bizarre.
Perfect.
But
it still counts.
Still counts. I'm here. You know, and I have a degree. But, you know, basically I said I'm going to sign something when I'm done and took this deal at EMI. And that song I was just saying, Another You, became my first cut as a songwriter. They had it cut within 2 months, and it was a top five song for a guy named David Kirsch. And so,
really? So you had some hits before you were a solo artist. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that.
And that was a soul write. So a top five country song, soul writer. I bought my first house within 3 months of, or three, not 3 months, 3 years of graduating. I had enough money to buy a house, which was good.
That must have felt pretty good for a young guy just out of college.
Yeah, there were those first 2 years, though, where you're a staff writer and I was making 22 grand a year, you know.
And at that time, were you thinking that you wanted to be a solo artist? Was that your ultimate goal?
Always, yeah. Right. Now, I had goal number one and then two and three and four backups, you know.
Right.
Number one, solo singer-songwriter record deal, tour, have a tour bus, hit songs, and an audience waiting to hear you playing. That was goal number one. The second goal would have been, okay, singer-songwriter / session guitar player would have been great.
Yeah.
Goal number three would have been, okay, I'm not having any hits as a songwriter, but I'm a session guitar player.
Right.
Goal number four would be, can't do any of that, but a record label has hired me to do something else, and I'm at least in this town and adjacent to the music part. You know, so
it worked out well.
Yeah, that's the great thing about that school is there are a long list of people that are exactly somewhere on that list, you know.
Right.
In our town.
Well, how did you go from being a staff writer then to getting a record deal?
Because I was it was actually very organic. I just they were pitching songs and guys like Alan Jackson and Garth Brooks were putting my songs on hold, and I had a song called "I'm Gonna Miss Her," the fishing song, which wound up being a number one record for me, thank goodness.
Right.
But Alan Jackson loved it, but he tried to put it on hold and found out that 2 hours earlier at Capitol Records, Garth had put it on hold. But then they found out, they had to like go back and look at where the pluggers were, because three pluggers had gone out with this after I'd cut this little demo of it. It's such a quirky, crazy song about leaving your woman because she won't let you fish.
And right.
And the next thing you know, George Strait had it on hold. So anyway, it wound up defaulting somehow to being on hold eventually for Alan Jackson, and he had it on hold for 2 months, and he went in to cut an album, and he had 11 songs on hold, and he cut 10, and he didn't cut mine, which was bizarre. And I wasn't that bummed. It was interesting.
Right.
I was like, you know what? I think I'm not. I said, put it on hold for me. And they said, well, you don't have a record deal. I said, I don't care. I'm not letting anybody else have it.
Right.
So.
Oh, do you have that option when you?
You do if they, if they. And they had signed me at that point, EMI had signed me to a production deal as well. Which was one way I got to have my buddy from college, Frank Rogers, produce me.
Right.
Was he was a. They signed him as a staff producer as well.
Right.
So I don't know, it's complicated. But basically, Arista Records said, okay, so Alan didn't cut this, but we sure like the guy that's singing it. What else has he got? So they went in there and they said, here. And they
Did you cut your own demos?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He went in and they said, here, you listen to these demos. And it was Long Sermon and Me Neither and Who Needs Pictures. And he didn't have to be, hadn't been written. I'm Gonna Miss Her was the second album. Those first two albums, they basically were given about 90% of.
Right.
When they asked to hear it. And then it was inevitable. They were like, well, he should be making records.
Right.
And that's how it worked. And in retrospect, it's the perfect way to do it. At the time, it just felt scary.
I mean, what was being a staff writer? What is that? liked? I mean, do you literally go in? Do you go in and sit at a you know, sit around with other songwriters and just yes. spitball ideas?
It's a fantastic lifestyle. I mean, most of my best friends are doing that.
Really?
Chris Dubois, Kelly Loveless, these guys, Brent Anderson, Tim Owens. That's what they do for a living. They're right. songwriters.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nashville has such a machine of that.
Right.
And so there's these couple of streets where everybody records and writes. And the publishing companies have rooms for writing. Songwriters have their own writer room in their house normally if they've had any success. And so 5 days a week, normally, except in the summer when they're golfing, half of them, they are writing songs. And they sort of pair off. And they're like, you know, it's this promiscuous songwriting society where it's like, these two hook up and then these two hook up and then this trio hooks up and then these two, and they're just seeing what happens, and they'll write with two or three of the people that they're very comfortable with, and they write with a lot two or three of the days of the week, and then on like an alternate day or two they'll go write with somebody new and right. see how that goes, which normally is a nightmare.
Really?
Yeah, it's like you're not familiar and you're right. not able to sort of say how not bad a line is.
Oh, right, right.
You know how you guys are in the studio. It's the same way as songwriters. It's like this thing where, and I'm so close to these guys when we make a record now, it's like you're stupid. You know what I mean? It's like they'll say, well, what about this line? You know, you broke my heart into 1,000 pieces. I'm like, yeah, that's not dumb. That's not been done 1,000 times already.
Right.
Why don't you go get coffee and make yourself useful?
Right,
you
know, right.
We have that.
Yeah, that comfort level.
Yeah, which is, there's nothing more annoying than sitting down with someone who throws out a mediocre line and you're like, well,
that might work.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I like that, but, you know, just cut past the red tape. But it's a fun existence. I think the Nashville songwriting community has it figured out.
I remember hearing for years that, like, country music and hip-hop were kind of immune from you know, the major label world crashing. Like, oh, well, country records still sell and hip-hop still sells. But I imagine that can't quite be...
We don't sell like we did. I
mean, right.
I don't know if that's true at all.
But it seems like nowadays, when a band, especially an established artist, puts out a record, it's got to be more than a record. You know what I mean? Like, Foo Fighters we've got like a TV show thing coming out.
You know
what I mean?
And I know that you've... fascinating.
It's going to be great. The shows are coming out really cool. But I know you've been... you've been hosting on a TV show too on Rising Star,
which is a great way of. It's sort of all about marketing.
Is that what led you to do that?
A couple of things. Originally, I said no when my manager basically walked in and said ABC, which I have a lot of ties to ABC. I host the CMA Awards on that network with Carrie Underwood, and that is the same network that has Nashville, which my wife was on, and. And so they're very invested in country music. And they said, ABC has a new reality show that's a singing competition. I said, nope. And he's like, no, seriously, you need to think of it. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do one of those. Because I was really tired of those. I was tired of that model. They're fascinating, but...
It made me think of that that line from your song, Celebrity.
Like, yeah, very much.
I can have no talent and just be on reality TV.
Do I have talent?
I was thinking, you know, do you sing that to the guys that you're kicking off the show?
No,
as they're walking out the door?
I'm much nicer than that. Ludacris does that.
Right.
He's good at that. But
no, are you enjoying it, though, now that you're doing that?
I am in love with it.
You seem very comfortable on the show.
I am in total love with it. Here's why. First, then my manager came back and said, before you say, like a week later, he says, before you really turn this down, look at this. So he shows me a tape of the Israeli competition, which is where they got the idea. And this singer walks out and sings, What If God Was One of Us?
Mm-hmm.
And that wall goes up halfway through the song, and the place goes nuts, and that person starts crying. And it's like, and I'm like, what happened? And he's like, people are sitting at home with their cell phone, and they're voting while they're singing. And if they get enough votes, the wall goes up. If it doesn't, they go home. And I'm like, that's the coolest thing I've ever heard of. Just, it's what we all do.
Right.
We're sitting there with our phone. I'm like going, I'm checking Twitter as I'm watching anything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So now you got a show where it's like, it's sort of like a football game, but you're calling the play. You're saying, you know, pass or run, you know.
It's like interactive to the extreme.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's to me, it's, we're on the razor's edge of this because this is the future. And, you know, hopefully our show, which has started to do well and is starting to catch fire, I feel, survives the razor's edge to become, you know, something that sticks around, because I'm loving it. Because to me, it's a great way to find an artist, because you're giving, you are putting them in a cauldron. I mean, right. A boiling pot. Sure. As opposed to sort of anything the least bit sugar-coated. It's right. Just so, there's just, and the other thing I like about it is that I don't have to be brutally mean to them. Right. Because they already know what America thinks when they walk down to us.
Right.
They're not, they didn't just perform and then have an entire night of little girls and boys texting right. their votes after I critique them.
Sure.
Like, I don't have to influence the vote that's finished.
Right.
I can give them encouragement, or I can tell them that just wasn't good enough, you know. And that the part I didn't expect about this is, first of all, the friendships. Like, me, Kesha, and Luda, and Josh. I knew Josh Groban prior. He's a hilarious and great guy. But those three, like, the three experts are thick as thieves. I mean, we go to dinner. The other day, I have a couple of songs in this new Disney movie, Planes, and
we're taking our son there tomorrow for his birthday party.
Oh, cool.
As a matter of fact, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, they said, what are you doing after we were mentoring with these kids all day? They said, what are you doing tonight? And I said, I got to go to the premiere. And he's like, well, Luda's like, well, let's go. So they went with me. They walked the red carpet. It's just like we became buddies. And for me, it's also the mentoring. It must be how a high school teacher feels.
Right.
When you got a kid that's got some talent. And you start to really care about their future.
Right.
But then they go off, and sometimes you don't know what happened to them. In sure. our case, it's like we're mentoring these kids. And there's one girl that to me sounds like Macy Gray or Amy Winehouse or something. I mean, she's coming up this week. And it's like, you know, so I'm like trying to tell her, look, here's the things you need to do. And because I really would like to see her raise the wall. Because to me, I like another voice like that on the
right.
radio.
Right, right.
And so it's so much more rewarding. It's like if she takes the advice and it helps her and she does get through, and let's say she's one of the final four and winds up with a record deal or something.
Is that the end, you know, the big prize at the end?
They
of
get
it?
A capital, yeah, deal in capital.
Oh.
Which is great. I mean, we got the one kid. Have you seen the kid that sounds like Stevie Ray Vaughan?
No. Jesse? Is he a guitar player?
He plays pretty well. Yeah, he does play the guitar. He's pretty good. But he sings like Joe Cocker, or I mean, he's 20 years old.
Right, right, right.
I'll show you a clip at some point. You won't believe him. I mean, it's cool. Like, okay, he belongs on the radio.
Does a show like that, is it seasonal, like a regular TV show? Like, how do you fit that into what you're touring and making records and everything?
In our case, it's only Sunday night and it's only live. So that was the beauty of it. It's not like 4 days of taping.
Right.
We do have days in between now and then when we mentor, like a couple weeks ago, but it's very, very small commitment in terms of the bang for the buck. And you're on TV and you're able to sort of show your personality, which right. I think is a good thing. And you know, in my case, it might be a bad thing at times, but you you have all of this opportunity to sort of change things in a good way and add to the musical landscape. And that would be a nice thing, to think that we gave the world a musical gift like a Carrie Underwood when this was over,
right. Sure, know? Sure. And does that fit into your touring schedule? Like, do you do that thing? I know, like, a lot of country acts are, like, do, like, a weekend touring schedule, you know?
Definitely.
Know, Thursday through...
Yeah,
I read somewhere that you fly home and sleep in your own bed every single night on tour. Is that true?
Not true, no. But I fly home as much as I can.
Right.
I got a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, so... Right. I mean, you got to do as much of that as you can. And Nashville has it figured out, because we're not out here on this West Coast where everything's a 2-day drive.
Right, right.
2/3 of the population's overnight drive for us. So right. we can do Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, be home Monday morning and
right.
be home until Thursday. Yeah, right. Be home there at that point.
How did that develop?
The family? Do I need to explain that? Or?
No. No, it's such an enviable thing, you know, coming from, like, I grew up in playing in bands where you would go on tour for 7 weeks, like, at right. a time, and you would just drive around the country over and over, like,
right.
that's the idea, and I kind of dream that at some point the Foo Fighters will start doing that, you know, that, and we kind of almost do it, because we only go out for, you know, a week or two at a time, generally.
Yeah, you guys are lazy as can be, you haven't played a gig in a year.
That's true.
You know?
That's true, but it's about to get very busy.
Good.
But that thing, like, Thursday through Sunday, I mean, that's a... that's a great schedule. Like, how did that? How come that developed in country music?
Well, I think it's out of necessity, because for some reason, there's a million, some scientists could explain this to you very much better than me, but for some reason, our fans are way more likely to go towards the end of the week.
Right.
Monday through Thursday is,
because you're getting rid of the whole, like, you know, Tuesday night in
we
the
barely ever
teeny
play
town with nobody yeah. there. They just now, erases guys, that whole thing.
You guys, it's probably in your case. I would imagine you're pretty much going to sell out anywhere now, the way that you guys have built. But there had to be a time when it was like, you know, Tuesday gigs, you had to dread them.
Yeah,
did they feel different?
It's absolutely. I mean, it's not so much that you dread; you just knew. Well, the stage is going to pretty much be pushed up against the seats
was
in
that
the back.
The way, was that the way it worked?
Oh, like
it
absolutely.
It wasn't sold out, basically.
Oh, yeah. No, and especially in America. America's been the toughest nut to crack. Although we do well here, mm-hmm. it's nothing compared to what we do all over the rest of the world.
Right.
And it still is kind of a struggle here for us.
Interesting. That doesn't feel that way to me. But, well, you know, I think you're going to see leaps and bounds this time. I mean, it'll be nuts this time.
Yeah, okay. We hope so. It's definitely going to be like a good rollout, and it's going to come out in a way that's like, you know,
well, you've
different
taken
than
the,
we've ever
right,
done.
You know, you're on this stair step pattern that's good, but the thing about us is that something about what weekends do in our format, they're truly like, that's, you got to imagine. I mean, we're playing for, especially in our format, we are playing for the people that keep the country going,
right?
And they have responsibilities all week. And they are going to blow off steam on the weekend, and we happen to sing the songs that they want to hear about that. You know?
Right.
We're so weekend-oriented as far as our format goes these days, with sort of a lot of that. I mean, one of my favorite hooks on the new album is, the first song on the new album is called Crushing It, and it's such a common phrase today, but it basically, you know, it tries to capture the spirit of what I look at every tour date.
Right.
And that is, like, the song is about not being great at anything. You know, it's like, I'm not great at this or that. I kind of blew it, you know, in this. And, my girl wanted me to hang these pictures up, and I dropped them, and they shattered, and that kind of thing. And it's like, she's like, aren't you good for anything? And the chorus is basically, every week has a weekend. And by this time, Friday night, I'll be done with my third can of Cold Bud Light, and I'll be crushing it. And that's essentially, you know, and when you look out there, for me, it's like you look at the lawn at the amphitheater. You know, these are people that are facing the wrong direction. That, you know, we have to make a loud noise to get them to look at, like, not over here.
Right, right, right. Sure, yeah, yeah.
It doesn't matter. We're like secondary.
Right.
They are going to party that weekend.
And sometimes you forget that. Sometimes you can be very self-conscious when you're on stage.
Oh, it's
and
like,
you
yeah.
forget that people are there to have a good time. Yeah, it's They're not, rooting for you.
Well,
they want,
like,
you to give them a good time.
It's like we have all these toys. Our tours are so, my tours are so high. Sort of high, like, technology.
Production, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We have, you know, the video wall, but then I do things with video that are, like, beyond just showing colors and splashes of
right,
stuff.
Right,
it's
right.
like, you know, I jump in a virtual pool of water at the end. It looks like a splash.
Right.
We have a holographic Carrie Underwood that shows up for a duet. We have a...
Really?
Yeah, we've got like...
When can you just have a holographic whole band and just send that on the road?
I'm working on that. That's
Let me coming. Know when you get that figured out.
Yeah, all of us would do that in a heartbeat. But, you know, and as well as like a B stage where we run to the back and play mm-hmm. to the people in the lawn and all of these things. And it's so funny because you'll meet somebody in the meet and greet after the show, and like someone will come up and it'll be like, you know, did you have a good time? And they're like, yeah, it was a good show. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like I just jumped into a virtual
right,
pool of water.
Right.
And
what more do I have to do?
Yeah, that was a good show. Yeah. And you realize it's probably, I don't know what's going on in their life.
Right.
You know, and then somebody else will be like, oh my god. It's like, what was your favorite part? They're like, I love that song. You know what I'm saying? I
well,
love
you,
the song,
you know,
Celebrity.
So it's I took my three boys, who are 10, 8, and 6, to go see Kiss a couple weeks ago mm-hmm. at the Forum, which was amazing. They've been to a lot of rock shows, but mostly Foo Fighters shows. So
how are they, I mean, live? I have not seen them since man, a long time. It
was fantastic. It was the craziest production I've ever seen. It was every song was the last song. Like, yeah, in terms of pyrotechnics.
Yes, exactly.
You know, every song they went for.
Like, well, they had to use it all up that time.
So it was crazy, dude. Blood and fire and flames and flash pots and everything. And my 6-year-old, about halfway through the gig, leans over to me and goes, "Daddy, what do dolphins eat?" Just like, what? Fish, what are you son. Thinking about? Like, look at what this Gene Simmons is right there blowing fire. But that's the live experience.
Yeah, that is some tightly stretched spandex at this point.
Oh yeah,
some of that.
You know what? They were amazing, and it's a guy playing the role of Ace Frehley and a guy playing the role of Peter Criss. So it's not the original guys, but they both did their jobs really well.
As long as you got Paul and.
They might need to replace Gene pretty soon. He's moving a little slow up there.
Oh, really?
Oh,
no,
yeah.
You can't replace Gene soon.
Well, I know, but,
leave it to him, though, to figure out how to market that.
Hey, man, I've heard that's their plan, once they get too old, get a couple of younger guys out
there. They're Batman. Legend, Mr. Wayne.
Exactly. Like, who's going to get the Gene Simmons role now?
Yeah, when you make yourself more than just a man.
Speaking of the live stuff, I put up on Facebook that I was interviewing you, and a lot of people wanted to know about your gear.
Okay.
So we got to nerd out a little bit on music.
I'd love
gear.
To talk about
like,
gear.
Do you bring a really crazy rig out with you live, or do you bring a bunch of amps that you're switching?
Yeah, there's
between?
It's a music store. It's like a, it's basically True Tone Music
right
there.
Oh, but nice.
I
love True Tone music.
Yeah, it's like you're in True Tone. It's like all these amps, but meanwhile, only two are on. But
Well, it's got to look like that, right?
Well, it's. I wish I could stick them all out there because they're really sort of backstage in a truck. But, because it's like it's more complicated than it needs to be, honestly. But it works pretty well. For a while, I was really into rare stuff and bringing that out more. Now the rarest thing I take on the road is a great 63 AC30 that is an essential part of the soup.
Right, sure.
It's coupled up with a couple of really great amps. Whether that's at any given time, there's two amps on. I sort of learned the hard way. I kind of got to have two on because I kind of run around a lot, and I'll frequently a tube will go down or something.
Sure,
one amp goes out.
Yeah.
If you're in a one amp setup and a big production thing and you're in a situation where you can't stop the song or something, then you're asking for it. So it's normally like an AC30 and a Dr. Z Z-Rec, which is a great amp. I mean, it's one of the best boutique amps I ever made, that model. I don't know if you've played through one or not.
I don't know. I know that brand. I don't know if I've ever actually plugged one in.
They got one here.
Oh, really?
At the have you been to the Guitar Bar?
Yes, that's actually a guy that I grew up with.
That is
that place.
Great
yeah.
store.
Oh, it's great.
I adore
fantastic.
Those people.
Jamie Folletti, who opened that, was he was a few years older than me and was friends with my older brother.
Yeah.
And he drove me to a lot of shows, but he would take me to go see like Yngwie Malmsteen down in L.A. and stuff like that. Like,
wow,
we go
there you
way
go.
Back.
That's amazing. Yeah, well, then good for him.
Yeah.
I think he's doing well, right?
It looks like it, yeah. I mean, I actually dropped in there recently and he wasn't there, but the store is fantastic.
I go in there like every time I'm out. West, but the
do you collect a lot of gear like on the road?
Have you bought
up like all the Paisley Telecasters in the world?
I own one actual old Paisley.
Oh, really?
And it's my main one that I've played my whole career.
Oh.
But I own a lot of replicas. I own a lot of like I've got a boutique builder named Bill Crook that builds me Tellies.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of old Fenders, but he builds me. He has mastered the art of sort of the. He like changes the color of a Paisley guitar. He'll do black and white, or he'll do blue, or he'll do anything, and he'll do sparkle or anything. Anything I come up with, he's like, oh, I'm gonna build you something.
Right.
Or he'll surprise me with one somewhere, and it'll be camouflage or something. And but I love gear. I mean, I am a gear whore, and for me, I got on this quest of I'm very British in amplifier preference. For me, it was a guy named John Jorgensen that was with the Desert Rose Band. Mm-hmm. And they came out in the 80s. And in the 80s, for a good portion of the first part of the 80s, I had the Mesa Boogie Studio preamp and rack full of stuff.
Right.
And that was what everybody did. And you put compression and chorus and a little bit of delay, and that was your sound. And, everybody might as well have been whatever, and had no person. It was basically like one of those sci-fi movies where everybody looks the same.
Sure.
And
Oh, I had many a Mesa Boogie. This the super duper high saturation, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I saw the Desert Rose Band, which was Chris Hillman from the Byrds.
Right.
And Herb Peterson, one of the greatest banjo player, harmony singers in history. And John Jorgensen, who is to this day my favorite guitarist. Who, John was playing a Tele or an ASAT, one of those, through two old Vox AC30s with Boss pedals.
Hmm.
And I went, oh my God.
Amp distortion? Was he driving it with the amp?
He played them clean.
Oh, and really?
So, yeah, because AC30 is pretty loud, clean. I mean, you can get up to noon with it. Clean with a little bit of dirt.
Just a little
just
bit.
Just enough.
Yeah.
You know, just that sort of sounds like they're playing in a bar. And it's so he used two of those, and I went, that's what I want.
Right.
And so I started, I got my first AC30 in college. My dad has funny stories about this because I borrowed the money from my father, and he says I still haven't paid him back, but that's not true. But you know, I got a couple of JMI AC30s when I was in college.
Mm.
And here I am. I would show up with two old 62 AC30s at a gig, and people are like, what the
hell? What are you using that old junk for?
Yeah, what is this kid doing? Or they were actually, by then, they were starting to get hot. They were like,
right.
Everybody's like wanting to figure out that AC30 thing. And for me, that was the sound that always made me a little bit more unique than just Tele and Defender, which was sort of like, that plus a little, like for me, it was a Boss DD2. That was the sound.
Was that the delay?
One of the first, digital delays, which was 8-bit. So it's got, it just messes it up a little, just
right,
enough.
But right. Puts a little dirt on it.
Dirt, but also like high frequency something.
Right.
You know, or an Aquapus, which is that way huge pedal. Which
yeah, sure.
I had a few of those early on.
Those pedals are great.
They're great. And so that was my sound, and then I started to venture out, and I bought some Marshalls and bought things that I use on for various sounds and recording, but for me, the other thing I started to get infatuated with was Trainwreck amps,
right?
Which was Ken Fisher and
sure.
This rare.
Did he pass away or something, and they don't make them anymore? Is that
he did?
Right,
and he also was such a nut. He was kind of like Dumble in that he would build one at a time. Every one of them had a character. He named them. He didn't number them. They were always named after a woman, and he only made about 80 amps. And and they were always a hardwood cabinet figured with a faceplate etched, and then a name on the back and a character. Like he made one for Billy Gibbons that's basically that really creamy saturated thing.
Right.
He made one for George Lynch that's basically goes to 11 the minute you turn the volume on.
Right.
He made one for a blues guy that's. Like a Liverpool's the name of that model, which I ended up buying his, which was like starts to get dirtier the more the volume goes up, but it's you roll that volume off a little bit and it's clean.
Right.
And then he made a really rare model called a Rocket, and the Rocket is actually what the Z-Rec is based on. He was good friends
really?
With Dr. Z, and the Rocket was his version of the perfect AC30.
Right.
And where he basically would go, he was the kind of guy that's like he would put things together, and he would go, he would decide on this one amp that this, you know, this wire needed to be gold instead of silver, or you know, gold instead of whatever it might
right.
be, and then he would change and say, you know, he believed that every component of an amp contributed to what the sum of the parts were,
right?
Like he only used the cord off of a vacuum cleaner as the power cable on an amp, because he said the way that it handled that thick sort of insanity.
Why?
But then you
must
you
have
hear
been a
it,
method to the madness.
You hear it and it's like, okay, that is the perfect amp. So
right.
I have one of the Rockets, which he only made 8 of those. And
oh, wow.
I use that in the studio a lot. The Z-Rec is really close. It's and in fact has some things that are in some ways maybe even better. But I put those together. Tony Bruno's another guy that I use a lot of his amps. He's a builder, boutique builder that builds me things. And
there's so many of those guys out there. There's so many boutique-y pedal guys, boutique-y amp guys, boutique-y pickup guys. It's like, it can be overwhelming.
It's totally overwhelming. You find something you like and use it.
Yeah.
But I feel like, I think having a signature sound for me in the beginning was very important. Because I wanted my records, I wanted people to know it was me playing.
Before they heard your voice.
Yes.
Right.
And try to have some sort of consistency that way. And You know, and that's always on my mind when I make a record now.
Right.
It's like, where's the guitar going to... And sometimes the fun part now is like, okay, so they know that Telly sound for me. It's so sort of normal on one of my records. Maybe it doesn't come in now to the solo. Like, maybe the whole first part of the song isn't entirely... is like a 330 or one of the Gibson or something.
Right, right.
And then all of a sudden, boom, here comes my Telly solo right. or something.
Right, right. Different colors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're boring whoever's listening.
No, this is the stuff that people want to know, man. Believe me. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, and because I know, you know, you were friends with Buck Owens, or didn't you?
Big
didn't
friends,
know
yeah.
him a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I you know what I did on the first album? I wrote him a note and said, because songs like a song like Me Neither, on that record is all that
right,
stuff,
yeah,
sort
yeah.
of those,
yeah.
those things. I wrote him a note and said, look. I just finished my first album. It's about to come out. I think if you listen closely, you will hear yourself. You know, just wanted you to
Did
hear
Did you
it.
Know him prior? Like at this point, you just sent this to him?
Sent it to him. So I get a call from his right-hand man, a guy named Jerry Hufford up there in Bakersfield.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you guys ever played up there?
Foo Fighters have, yeah.
You, got, you didn't
I've
take your band up?
No, I played at the Crystal Palace.
Did you?
Yeah, it was amazing.
With
yeah,
the Dead Peasants?
We did, and then I went back when I was playing up there at a different place, and I sat in with the Buckaroos up there
That's
for a couple
best.
Of tunes. It was crazy.
You never got to meet Buck?
No, no. This was after he had passed. I did meet his... The first time I played there, his son was there.
Yeah, Mel. Or Michael.
No.
Buddy.
Buddy. Buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Who
so
looks
I,
just like him. It's like uncanny.
Oh, yeah. He sings like him, too.
Yeah.
So I get a note back from him. I get a phone call from Jerry Hufford that says... This is Jerry Hubbard from the Crystal Palace. He said, Buck listened to your record. He loves it. I said, that's amazing. Thank you. And he goes, he wanted to know if you really played all those guitar parts yourself. And I said, I did. That's all me. And he said, Buck says bullshit. And he'd like for you to fly out here and prove it. And I went, you say when? And he's like, okay, so we booked a date. A couple of weeks later, I get on a plane and I fly to Bakersfield. And Buck's playing at the Crystal Palace. And this is like 1999. And he says, all right, I got a kid here that's going to... And they introduced me backstage ahead of time. And I mean, you don't understand. The first record I can remember, my first memory as a child is very possibly running around in circles to Tiger by the Tail.
Right.
Because I used to do that. They would put that song on, and I would run around in the living room until I would fall over. I was so dizzy.
Right, right,
and then I would
right.
cry when they would stop playing it.
Really?
Run again.
That's amazing.
So, I mean, he, for me, is, you know, he and Roger Miller, to me, are some combination of that is what I've always wanted to be.
Right.
And
yeah, I hear some Roger Miller in your lyrics.
Yeah, you know. And I've gotten to be best friends with Bill Anderson, who was best friends with Roger Miller. And the
oh,
stories
really?
About Roger Miller are just... That was the quickest way. He was like a Mark Twain in
right.
some way. He was just
right.
the quickest. You ever hear the Ronnie Millsap story?
No.
He would walk up behind Ronnie Millsap and cover his ears and say, guess who? You know what I mean?
That's funny. The Buck thing, did he ever sit down and play guitar with you?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, we did a ton of stuff. Like, I used to go there on off days in California and spend the day there and work out at the gym and then have dinner with him and sit
right.
in with the band. I mean, I spent 4 New Year's with him.
Oh, really? So you guys were tight.
Yeah, we were really, he would call me a lot. I mean,
right.
we were really tight.
He oh, was, wow.
He was, for me, it was a very surreal experience because I felt like of all the artists that have ever gone before in country music, you have the most to learn from Buck Owens.
Right.
Because here's this guy that, you know, like Harlan Howard wrote something about him once, and I remember it stuck with me. It was like, he's not the best looking guy that's ever put on a nudie suit. You know, he ain't the best singer in the history of our format. That's George Jones.
Right, right.
He ain't the best songwriter. That's Harlan Howard, the guy writing the article, you
right.
know. But he's arguably one of the biggest stars we've ever had.
Right.
How? And you know, when you think about it, it's absolute total package marketing,
right.
genius,
right.
appeal.
And grueling hard work.
Great band, hard
yeah.
work, musicianship.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, that was always my goal. It's like, all right, make records people like, be yourself, be likable, have a personality, get to play for all these folks, do your thing. That to me was always it. And then on top of that, here's this guy that, I mean, Buck published Merle Haggard.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
It's that. It's like he died with $300 million in the bank.
I get the feeling from a lot of those guys, and especially, and I didn't know him, but from that generation of players,
yeah,
that they were a lot less sort of sentimental about what they did.
No doubt.
Than we are.
Well, I think that...
It was work. It was a job. It was almost like there was this working class mentality, and those guys came out of like hard scrabble stuff that like we didn't have to deal with.
Without a doubt. Well, I used to... This is a funny story. You know, as you know, as you progress, you add to the count of buses and trucks on the road and things. And Buck never understood, because in his day, a bus was an extravagance.
Right.
They were normally in a Cadillac. So it was like, you know, he would be okay with an artist getting a bus. But the minute you were at two buses, he did not understand the need for that second bus.
Right.
Let alone a semi.
Right.
So when we would visit in later years, when I wound up with like more than one bus and a truck and things that it started to grow... I would
be like,
park.
Son, you are wasting your money.
No,
what are you doing?
No. I didn't tell him. I would park him when we would. I would take my whole crew to see him at the Crystal Palace, and my band would play for him. And
oh wow,
like all my guys got to back him up at one point or another. Yeah. Like he came and sat in at a gig that we did in near Bakersfield and things. Oh, wow. Like he would show up a lot.
He was no slouch as a picker.
No, he was great, especially in his day. Player. You know, he played on sessions.
Yeah. And I had read somewhere that he claimed that he taught Don Rich how to play, and I just thought, oh, come on. No, you didn't. And then I found this footage of him on YouTube where he goes up and he takes Don Rich's guitar, and he just starts ripping a lead.
Like, sounds like
and
Don it's Rich. Like,
oh, I guess that was – I guess he wasn't just, you know,
no, he
talking
was,
nonsense.
He was brilliant. And he – but, you know, in his case, we would hide the other buses. We would park all the other buses down the street, and we would take mine to the Crystal Palace
that's
and park
funny.
It there, so he still thought I had the one.
Right.
Even to the day he died, I think he thought I had one bus.
Oh, that's great. Well, that must have felt pretty good going and playing the White House, I think. As such a Buck Owens fan, I know he made that famous live record there. There's like a real, like, you know.
There is. It's such a crazy thing. I mean, he was like, he would have been really proud of that.
Right. Well, thank you for coming down, man. I think
man,
that pretty much covers
it was fun.
Your whole life.
I can't wait to hear you guys again. Thank you for playing country music as a hobby. It's amazing to me. That you love it this much. It was so refreshing to
thank you
discover that you're doing this.
I really meant that. I was glad that I didn't know you were there until the set was over, because I was like, oh, it made me nervous even then, but I would have been a wreck.
It was great. It was this honky tonk vibe, and what's, you know, how many Merle Haggard songs can one band cover? And
it's funny, we sat down. Do you know, I mean, I know you know Red Volkert.
Oh, we're best buddies. He played my wedding. Do you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Red was my wedding entertainment.
Well,
I flew him to California
for
my wedding, and that was our band. We had this. We got married in Malibu. We did it at the chapel at Pepperdine, and we went down to the softball fields and had softball games and a band, and the band was Red Volkert.
Oh, wow. Because I was at the Continental one night years ago now. And I was watching, I don't know if you ever see that Sunday night thing he does there.
We've gone down. Set in.
And I was watching him, and I was just going, this is what, because I love era of country music. I just love those songs. And I'm like, I don't play guitar like this. I mean, I'll never play guitar like Red Volkert, but I don't
think
those guys. I don't, you know, like it just isn't in me. I'm an Ace Frehley, Angus Young kind of guitar player. And I just thought, I need to just get my band. We're just going to learn this set. We're just going to learn all these songs. We're learning as many of these as we can. We've been doing that for the last couple
years. I wish there
was
a way to get the that to be in the public consciousness, because there's no way you can't like that music.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if you ever see Red play live, it's the coolest thing you've ever seen. It's mind-blowing. It's jazz. It's you know, jazz licks and then...
Oh, yeah. And playing through that weird, like, a PV and some, like...
Yeah,
it's
an old steel amp. It's a
right. Yeah, it's like it's not an easy tone to make sound good, and that guy just makes it sound like magic.
It's such an interesting guy. I mean, he changed my playing more than anybody.
Really?
Because around the time
was he playing down at Robert's Western World when you first came to town?
I became aware of him then, but when we started going to, he'd moved to Austin and started setting in with him. I flew down a couple of times and sat in with him.
Oh, really?
Just to learn, just to be on stage with him, because he makes me puff up and go, okay,
right.
I really have to think now.
Yeah.
And it's fun to find a guitarist like that. It's like that is that basketball player that makes you have to run the court.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And
brings everybody's game up.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, that was, we became good buddies. And then around the time I was getting married, I said to my wife, my wife's like, well, are we gonna have any music? And I'm like, it's not a DJ. I'm telling you that right now. We're not having a DJ. I'm not going to have dancing to a DJ at my wedding. That's the stupidest thing ever. I'm going to have my whole band out there. I'm like, we need a band. I'm trying to think of who. She's like, well, who would be your dream guy? I'm like, Red. I'd have Red do it. So I called Red, and I'm like, I think it was like, I was like, so I'm getting married in a month. Do you want to? He's like, well, I'm there. When? I'm like, it's Sunday afternoon in Malibu. He's like, fantastic. How much you want? He's like, I don't care. I think we paid him $2,500 or something.
Great.
To fly in, you know.
I interviewed him for this a while ago, and his story, like, I knew his guitar playing, but his story is like so amazing. It's great.
Played for Merle for a while.
Yeah.
He's something.
Well, right on, man.
Thanks,
Thank
man.
You so much.
You're welcome.
Much appreciated. Boy, down at the street fair. It's a French kiss, Italian ice. Spanish moss in the moonlight, just another American Saturday night. Yes, yes, ladies and gentlemen, that was Brad Paisley on Walking the Floor.
Very cool, very cool.
That concludes the epic two-part adventure with Brad Paisley, Walking the Floor.
I'm going to go to a music business school now.
I'm going to go take guitar lessons for the rest of my life and try to cop his licks. Well, all right. Well, I have a bunch of interviews in the can, so tune in 2 weeks from today, and you might hear me talking to Sturgill Simpson. Yeah, it might be Sturgill Simpson. It might not be, though. It might be Jim Lauderdale. It might be Jack McCoy, legendary surf filmmaker.
You just got to be on your feet and ready to listen.
Just be ready out there. Come on, walk on the floor, people. All right, signing off. It's my good friend Luke.
Good night, y'all.
And your old pal, Chris Shiflett. Adios, amigos. I bet it never, ever dreamed we'd have.